Accession number 14972, Richard Atkinson, reel 16.
You moved on from Langevin and the cornfield action to the Tilly area. What was happening down there?
Well, it was constant shelling again. It seemed to... You had to fight for every inch of road you took, and the fellows would begin to think there was no roads in France because they were living in fields and crossing fields. But that was where we had to... Well, we seemed to take Tilly, lose it, take Tilly... Went on and on. They flattened it. There was a bomber raid on it. We had to clear a way through it. It was a terrible time, really. It was open country by this time as well, and that wasn't helping anything.
Were you still running back for supplies and bringing them
yes,
up? Is this
yes,
still your job?
That still went on. But I wasn't going up to the front so much with them now, because the front was partly on hand. It was just a short trip. If the lad was just in reserve, I think they got it wasn't so bad, but if it was in no sort of steady, you didn't linger.
What was it like moving around the very close Bocage countryside with the very narrow lanes?
Oh, it was terrible, because you couldn't see anything. It was like being in a gully. Well, there were gullies, so the hedgerows, and that was that high either side, and the stench of the cattle round about you, it was into everything, the smell of dead cattle and whatnot. But it was evidently Napoleonic thing here. Napoleon had thought this idea up for Bocage for protection, and it worked, because you couldn't get through it, you couldn't see, and he was dug into it, and you didn't know anything, and he covered you. And you were just living on the side of ditches and gullies and...
Have you any other memories of this time?
Well, Mount Pincon, you know, when we were there, when we had took out and he chased us back and we took it. And my memory of Mount Pincon, because I was wounded there, by this time it was the 14th of August, when we'd actually broken out and we're getting ready to close the Felicity Gap now. And, we'd had enough of Tilly, because it was flattened. In the Bocage country, it was a menace. You didn't know from one minute to the next if you're going to survive that. And worse again with transport, you seem to be a sitting target. When we come to Pincon, and he brought his panzers up by this time, and we really knew what we had on our hands when they were there, because we had nothing to touch them. They were the ultimate weapon, sort of. The infantry could do nothing with them. It had to be a tank battle. Infantry didn't like tanks one little bit.
Had you been working with your own tanks?
Oh, yes. Your own tanks wouldn't go. If there was any danger of a tank or in there, the tanks wouldn't go in. They called you up to clear it. But if the tank coming up, the tank battle would develop. But because you had... By this time, we had 6-pound anti-tank guns, and we were protecting the tanks, and they were there protecting us. You know, it was one of those things where you work hand in hand, but you had the Typhoons as well, the Tiffies, and they were the bees' knees. You know, you put your RAF man was up with you, and if you were held up with a Panzer or a Crossroads, you contacted him, he called him up on his radio, and they were there, no trouble, rockets out. It alleviated a lot of trouble. You all had yellow neckwear, and you just used to stand together to let the Typhoon pilot know where we were, and he picked up from there, and from that on. He used to wear them as a scarf, normally, but until one needed.
And each band was issued with one?
Each band had a yellow scarf that was for aircraft recognition, and you could just stand in a big line or a narrow or thing, and you'd slip on the ground and show the Typhoon pilot where stuff was, pointing in his direction. And the RAF man was there on the spot and directing it.
You mentioned being attacked by, I think, American aircraft earlier
yes.
on.
I still see that. Oh, the American aircraft on the beach, yes. Yes. Oh, yes, they stopped as my friend Jimmy Probert lost his arm there. Got shot in the arm. And we still see it was American aircraft because the Germans, we never, you know, I don't think they realised. I didn't think they had any there.
Were there any other mix-ups?
Yes, well, I was wounded by friendly fire. I still say to this day it was friendly fire when I got wounded.
How did that happen?
Well, there again, I came in and I had rations on the truck, getting on for 4 o'clock-ish. I must have been back to bring the rations up for the next day. In a 3-ton truck, and I was in this gully, the side of a field or whatever it was, I don't know. And my sergeant, Joe Madison, come across, he says, "Dick, take the stuff off your truck and we'll use it for the picket for tonight, for patrolling around the lane, you see. You had to have them, because in case you had patrols and whatnot, out of his tongue." But this on Mount Pinkan, it was only a hill, which was overlooking him. And we had 2 days for it. We lost tanks and everything there. Dragoon Guards was with us. They were the tank men. And incidentally, that's the same one that was in Lille. Come in at 4 o'clock. I took the boxes of stuff off, piled in a heap. I says, "There's empty truck." And I laid me blankets down on the deck, and I must have laid on them, you know, lying, smoking or something, I don't know. And this plane come over and so he says, "Oh, there's a lightning," which is American. "He bombed us," and I got hit. And I finished up full of shock. But somebody said it was a lightning. I didn't see it yet until it was hit. And I still see it was friendly fire, the old American lightning.
Can you recall actually being hit?
Yes.
Every
time I can recall being hit.
What was he like? What happened?
Well, it's not like what you see in the pictures where they jump up in the air and fall on their face and that. You feel it thump you, and it's that hot, you don't feel it. You know what I mean? It hits you and you can feel the impact, but you don't feel anything at that minute because it's so hot. And I think it could be shock, I don't know. And then you sort of crump your knees and you go down the heap. But I was lying down, so it didn't make no difference. But you go down. And then that's a bit it burns because the heat of it is that hot when it hits you, you don't feel it, to be honest. And then you feel a pain about 2 or 3 minutes afterwards.
And is that bad?
Yes. Well, in my case, yes. But I seem to get wounded in the back every time. And you kind of see nothing, and it's just a shower of blood. And I'm petrified of blood. And they. Because the medic comes straight away and they whip you back to your own regimental aid post and they take you back to field ambulance, and I finished up in a Canadian hospital.
Did you shout for the medic?
Oh, yes. I shouted. Oh, yes. When I got wounded, nobody got away. But you see, when anybody else gets wounded, I should run away because I'm afraid of blood. I can't stand the sight of blood, even now with my own children. And I should run away. But when I got hit, nobody was allowed to run away. They all had to come minister to me, sort of style. Somebody would come across and stick a hand on or a field dressing or something, and they'll get you back to our own MO in the Isorley.
How far away would he be?
Oh, he'd be there. He'd be there with you. I mean, we've had a Canadian MO, we've had an American MO and all sorts, but they were there with you.
You recall the man at this time, to call his name?
No, I couldn't. Oh, my sergeant, I'll be with him tomorrow. He was his driver. Slipped it for the minute.
So you were taken back to the, well, not or taken to the MO, or the MO came to you?
Oh, they just dragged us back to him, I suppose.
What was his immediate task with your wound?
Well, you just look at it and put a clean dressing or something on and stick a label on you. Gunshot wounds, chest, gunshot wounds, back, whatever it is. That's all it was.
Did you know how bad the wound was?
No.
And he didn't tell you
No, he didn't tell you anything. He just, name, rank, number, gunshot wounds, chest. Tied onto your equipment or your coat or whatever it was tied onto you, and that was it. And you were passed back then to the 149 field ambulance. They picked you up
with an ambulance.
Picked you up. See, if if there wasn't, the regimental aid post would take you down on, you know, makeshift ambulance, a jeep or something. And but the field ambulance, 149 field ambulance, which is always with us, they were with us all the time, they minister, you put you in an ambulance, and there's a proper medic with you, and he sort of give you a shot of morphine, and, you know, mark it on the card, you know, whatever it was. Maybe Jal Ramo had give you a shot of morphine, I don't know, because they were empowered to. And then you went, you were passed back down the line. And I didn't know at the time, I thought it was home. I said, oh, I'm going to England. Because, oh, had all been gone. But by this time, the Canadians had a hospital in Corsair, in the beach, and I just went back to there. And I never went there. I was operated on there and whatnot. I was convalescent in the next field.
Was it gunshot wounds from the aircraft that you had, or shrapnel from bombs?
Well, it was gunshot wounds, whatever it is, you see. But it had to be a bomb. You know, shrapnel from a bomb. But everything is gunshot wounds. If it's a machine gun bullet or a rifle bullet, it's still gunshot.
And what wounds had you got?
A shrapnel.
Where about?
In the back. In my back.
One place, two place?
I think it was one that time. But when I was wounded in the desert, it was shrapnel and a machine gun bullet entered and came out. But the shrapnel stayed in. And this one was shrapnel was in, but they took this one out. But the first one is still in.
So you were taken back to the Canadian hospital. Was that in a building?
No, it was a tent. But I mean, we didn't know. We just took in this place, and when there's some green howards next to us in the bed there, and it was hot. Well, it was August. It was very hot because we'd had the storms and that. And the tent bed was marked on the wall behind me, so the top of the tent walls through the day. And I'll try and penicillin now by this time. And they didn't dress your wounds. They just give you penicillin later, but it goes over your wound. But when you went in, I think, if I remember, the operating table seemed like the tailboard of a truck. I can't remember, hazy. You know, you're not in your right mind, you're under morphine and whatnot. And I can remember them saying, do you want a shrapnel? And I said, no, I don't want a shrapnel. And if you did, when you come to, it was tied in a bit, bandage on your wrist. If you didn't, there was a big pile outside the tent door where they just threw it away. Stuff was taken out of people. But it was, it seemed to me to be like two tailboards of a truck let down 11 inches. But it couldn't have been, it must have been a problem. But it was just tentage. But it was Canadians. Because when I come round, as I say, I was in this bed and they were testing penicillin. Some could take it, some couldn't. And I was one that could. And they just give you these injections every 4 hours or where it was. It seemed to go on for days and days and days. You got sick of it. And that was it. Never dressed a wound, just later goes on, it healed itself. So it eliminated the gangrene and all that caper.
And these were Canadian doctors?
Canadian doctors and nurses.
And female nurses?
Female nurses, Canadians. And you see, the thing, it just healed itself. They didn't touch it at all. It's cleansed and covered, and that was left.
So how long did it take to heal?
Oh, I think I must have been there about, well, the course of penicillin seemed to go on and on. It must have been 4 days, 5 days, I think, in there. And then, see, because I remember the nurses used to make booze, illicit booze, and they'll give you it. You know, say, do you want a little nip? But it was a different atmosphere that was. You see, when I was wounded, I finished up the South African hospital, which I've said, and it was good. You avoided British hospitals because they were lied to attention business. And this one, it was free and easy, lax, you know, it was great. And you didn't say sir to the nurses, because they were the captains, but you just said, your system, miss, or what. And then you were marked, if you couldn't take penicillin, this man must not have penicillin, it was choked on the tent wall. Well, as I said, during the day, you should drop the tent walls, it was so hot. At night time, just hook them back up. Well, in the course of time, they got moved along the numbers. So when it come this night, I think I was on about my last one or two. And by this time, they're like a pincushion, because, jabbing you. And she looked at me, and she said, oh, you're finished. I said, oh, good. You don't have any? No, I don't have any. Usual army again. Well, what had happened, my number got the fellow next door to me, Green Howard, who couldn't take penicillin, so she gave him my job. And when I looked, he was frothing at the mouth. He was in a terrible state. We had a show for her. And I came out, he should have had mine, the tent ward. And I got a right rollicking for that time. She said, you could jeopardise that man's life. I mean, she did. The really person we placed, you know, it was a stupid thing to do when I think of it now. But in those days, I was just missing a thing. But he recovered, of course. But that's the sort of place it was. It was free in his real Canadian style, you know, you're out in the backwoods and that. But the poor Green Howard, he...
Were you on typical rations, or because the hospital was better?
Well, it was on Canadian rations, which is automatically better. But, honestly, I can't remember the food, because, I mean, you're lying in the white sheets, and you had a pair of pyjamas on and stuff like that. But you weren't loaded up, but you're just lying there.
How long was it before you got on your feet?
I think about a week. And then the first convalescent, which is on the next field in the tent.
And what was the difference between hospital and convalescent, other than the fact, of course, that you...
Just
you
a room. I could walk around that field. I couldn't walk in this field. I was in a bed. It was only different. Actually, they said it was convalescent. That was about 4 or 5 days until they sorted out where I had to go to and whatnot. But you see, I don't know if it's an unwritten rule with the Durhams. If you had a Durham, you had a Durham, you go back to them. Because that seemed, didn't matter what happened to me, you went back to the 9th. And if you were 8th, you went back to the 8th. And when you went back to the regiment, they didn't see where you'd been. They just said, it's a truck over there. They never asked you. They knew you'd been wounded or everything, but you'd think you'd just be on leave. They said, oh, you better, you know. But as I say, I was in this field, and all of a sudden, you see, I had Canadian berry, Canadian toothbrush, Canadian toothpaste, Canadian razor, and all the best of stuff. It was one of them shit rolled razor things, you know. Oh, great, fantastic. I didn't shave, but I had this razor. You know, it was all top class Canadian stuff. Canadian berry with a leather band on, I was a big cocky thing. And all of a sudden I said, right, up there in the prison truck, and it took us to the, I found out it was the River Seine. That's around until France, Paris. And I can remember getting off, we crossed a pontoon bridge or a bridge of some sort, and walked up a hill. It seemed like one and one to get up. And that famous cathedral was on the left, the Notre Dame, well, I don't know, that cathedral anyway, Montmartre, is it Montmartre? And there was transport there, you know, the 40 men or 8 horse trucks. And I just went back up, took 2 or 3 days for the finish up in Brussels, where the lads I just liberated. I rejoined them at Brussels. So I missed liberation of Lille, which is just down the road, and I joined them at Brussels.
And nothing had changed with the battalion?
No. I just drove in, they said, there's a 3 to that Gibson, quarter horses over there. As if I'd been on a 48-hour pass. They didn't ask, are you all right? The only first thing they said to me was, get that stuff handed in. You know, it's not our issue. And next thing I see, my MTO, Hooper, at a Cooper, wearing my berry that I get off a Canadian berry. Yeah. He could, he was an officer, he was a captain, I wasn't. But the thing, I mean, I didn't hand the razor and stuff over, no way, but the berry in a Canadian uniform had to be handed in. And
did you get much chance to see Brussels, the situation that was
no, they had liberated, you know, on the outskirts then, were into Belgium, you know, were crossed into, is it Louvain, and that way we were pushed up by this thing.
And where did you go to next?
Lens, was it Lens, that way on? Crossed.
Would this be moving towards Geel?
We're moving towards Geel and Eindhoven by this time. That's the way we're heading, up towards Geel and Eindhoven.
And were you back again onto the same routine?
Back exactly the same routine. Collect the rations, help yourself to Keon stores, and as if I'd never been away. The only thing is they give us another gold stripe. No, you wouldn't. You wore gold stripes on your arm, little gold stripes. They give us another one of them to put on. That was the only difference.
Game itself, did you get involved in that?
Well, I don't know. Is a queer do happen there with the 9th. And I think we took a place there, and there was a huge warehouse, it was full of Holland's gin. Went in, we took it, the carriers was loaded up with cases of Holland's gin, So much of them I took for the officer's mess, and all sorts of lads had bottles and cases of it. And I was drunk. There was a German say, come back and then he took more prisoner. And I've got a feeling that was round about Giel. But he knew exactly what he was doing. He left that hole in his chin there for him to get out. And of course, you want to come out, then all that be scrapped. It was all torn away and everything. I suppose also would keep so much. But the carriage you couldn't see for cases of Holland's gin. And I think, you know, your name's good. I can remember there, I went in, it was a jeweller's shop. And there was a little travelling, red travelling alarm clock on the shelf in the window. Wasn't much else. And I went to get it. Go through the door, and the fella barred the door. He wouldn't let us in, so I just kicked the window. And I put my hand, took the clock. Little red leather case travelling clock. I had it for years and years and years. You know, folded into three. And he scarred it, and I went through. And in the jeweller shop, you had shelves, and there was watch movements. Shelves of straps, shelves of winders and cases, and I just scooped them all in a sandbag. And when I came on leave, I had them for a long, long time. Came on leave, I can remember giving the father-in-law this lot, and he got one made up complete, and he had for years and years and years. And I threw the rest away. But those, that was the stupid things you did.
Was it an offence to take things if you were caught?
Yes. Oh, strict, very strict. You see, when we invaded, you could change £2 a day post order. Now nobody drew any pays, but the French was using French money, the Germans was using French money. The French wouldn't accept our military money, so we were using French money. Well, if you went in a shop or a bank, I think, and all the French money was lying about, you took handfuls of it. The Germans took handfuls of it, and you could change the YMCA, the Tuckage, Salvation Army. They're all, your own unit was changing, you could change £2 a day and send it home. That was stopped, evidently, by the first 4 months of the invasion of Summit. The country had lost £3 million or something in this money lock. Everybody was sending it home, £2 a day. You're supposed to get an officer's signature, but you didn't, you just got it. Saying put an envelope and send it home. I mean, Joan, she reckoned I had about £60 in no time at all. You know, well, same here, by this time, you had a duty-free label, and you get stuff, you see. No, I shouldn't say this, but I'm still using monogram tablecloths and that, you know, that I got. And what you should do, you should go to the post corporate and say, give us a duty-free label. And you should say, what's it is? What have you got? And I say, oh, no. Well, can I have that? Can I have that? No, that's mine. You give you a duty-free label, and you put in that thing, and all he do is stick his own label over the top of yours and send it to his own address. So you may as well give him what he wants in the first place and get your stuff through. Brooks was sending gramophones to him. He used to come on leave push chairs with gramophones and all sorts in. The ones that stick around are stick on firearms and daggers and that sort of thing. Because a lot of the fellas was getting their Lugas and whatnot. You see, the Yanks was going balmy on them. And they were getting them, flogging them. And they were strict on firearms and weapons. The customs wasn't too worried about this gramophones and stuff like that in Benton. But that's what you should do, you see, when you these places. And I had a truck, you see, I could put this sandbag of stuff in the truck, little suitors, but a company lad couldn't, and he couldn't think. As I say, this post corporal, his nickname was Skimmy, because he was like greedy, he used to skim everything off, you see.
What was his other name?
Jackson. Corporal Jackson. Post corporal. So you'd far better him have his pick, and he'd go get your stuff through. But if you didn't, he just took his label over the top of yours, and he got it in any case. So. But see, that was Luton if you were caught, you would have been a court martial. But the officers don't see, and the paddy was doing it, I mean, anything else.
Were you seeing more civilians by
yes.
now?
Yes, oh yes. Because you're getting into Holland by now.
And what was the reception you got? You know, obviously you joined them in Belgium, I know, but what was the kind of reception you were getting?
Oh, they were friendly. You could go in the houses and take in the houses, and they were friendly, you know, and they're giving you drinks and whatnot. Much, you know, friendly. And they were pleased to be free, to be honest. You know, that had enough of the Germans, which they had a very rough time, especially Holland. And they were free to, you know, they were pleased to see they were happy. And, you know, you were going in their houses and you sleep in their beds and they were sleeping in the cellars, because you're still shelling and whatnot, but, you know, you could get that beautiful, comfortable bed with duvets on. You get your boots on and things. They didn't worry. It was yours, the freedom of the place.
So what time of the years would this be advancing into Holland?
Well, I got one in August, September. Well, I'd say round about September, November area. Round about then.
What was happening to you there?
Well, you were just fighting your way up then, because Market Garden came on the scene then with an Arnhem and a paratroopers, and we were lucky enough to get picked again, but to fight up the corridor to get them out.
Do you have any memories of that?
Oh, yes, activity? I can remember Horrocks coming and getting trapped with us, and our carrier's getting them out. And he came to me, he says, "Wasn't I lucky? You know, he got out." Because we were fascinated. Oh, yes, I can remember Horrocks. I remember when we jumped off that morning with the car's armoured. We went up the road, and the first man I saw was an SES man. I'd never seen a film before. He had a blueberry on, a pale blueberry nut, and he just stood in the oil, sort of raised his hand as we passed him. How long he'd been there, I don't know. Whether he's waiting to transport or making his way, I don't know. But he must have been there long before us. But we had never seen, didn't know what it was, to be honest. And so he says, "Oh, that's that special mob, the SEA. And then, turned the corner, there's a bloody American paratrooper standing. All his parachutes had draped around him. He says, "Where's the sign to open place?" I says, "Well, it's down there, but we've just, no Germans here." I mean, he had landed miles away. And that's when I went up the corridor through Graves into Eindhoven.
Were you stopped from time to time with the Germans attacking you?
Yes, they cut the corridor twice. Once, I can remember, and once in that time when somebody said they cut it, that's when Horrocks got trapped, when they cut the corridor, because it was only a road. And until we got amongst them, the palace was just holding it, you see. The Americans and it was all Americans up to Eindhoven.
Horrocks, you say, got trapped, and you say the carriers got him out.
Yes, the ninth carriers got him out. The road was cut, and he must have been there, you know, somewhere. He'd have his aide de camp and all that lot in contact, and they just, ninth carriers brought them out round through the fields and whatnot, got them out and brought them back, and then rejoined us.
Was the battalion moving in transport at this stage?
Yes, and it was strict road discipline. The Red Caps decided who was on the road and who wasn't on the road, you know, because it was only a road, and if a truck got out of line, I think, or come across, everything was held up, and it was a strict timetable, and they decided who was on the road. The ninth was on the road this time, and you pull off, and the eighth was on, but it was strict military road discipline.
Any other memories of that particular event? Because it was quite a difficult one.
Yes, it was a difficult one, and then we got to Eindhoven, Nijmegen, we got to Nijmegen. And there, you see, he was floating mines on the river, he shunned it, you could see it, and that was Germany. And they say the Rhine, were the wall, but it was the Rhine. And I remember they put nets across the river to stop them floating the mines down. We went to Eindhoven, and there was a bridge, just like the town bridge, and he had shelled it, there was a hole in the middle, and they put a bailey bridge over that, over the hole. There was a railway bridge with a train standing on it, and there was a somebody says a Dutch resistance underground worker who was hanging that hung him because he took the fuses out or something, or the detonators out. But anyway, he was hanging there to cut him down. And we just, amongst the people, I think we were trying to get the pallets out. We got over what we called, to a place called Elst, over this bridge, and we called it the island because he flooded it. It was orchards, and it was just a road raised up, and we couldn't get no further. That's when the pallets had to come back out to us. That's as far as we could get to them. But he shelled that every day and whatnot. There used to be a Red Cap sitting in a little, a steel tomb thing on the bridge regulating the traffic, and he probably said, "Oh, go on, no, not." But I got shell coming across there, and the truck got hit coming across there. And this Joe Morrison, now I see him now, panic again, you put your foot down, he stops up. He made a stop. He said, "No, get the low gear." He says, "There's men on the back. There's blood running out. There's men in the back." He made me drive over dead slow. See, he was that type of man, cool, calm, collected. I drives gently, I got him off the bridge and could get him to the medics. But I would have just come charged over hell for leather, hit the bridge, and you know, they've been thrown all the place. I just wanted to be off. But he made me come bottom gear and crawl across them.
Were you hit with shrapnel again?
No, I wasn't wounded, but the fellas in the back was. I was lucky I wasn't wounded.
That was shellfire?
Yeah, it was shellfire.
What was your task while you were on the island? Were you backwards and
forwards?
Yeah,
just go with stuff, take men in, bring the you're just going up with what they wanted, if they wanted anything, or if they had to come out for a bath, go up and bring them down for a bath and stuff like that. That's when he first bumbled with the jets, machine gunners with the jet planes. It was on a Sunday morning, having a church prayer, and this jet came over, never seen anything like my life, and poof, the machine gun flew away. So he said, that was a jet.